The BBC presents A Composer and His Public, a talk in which Michael Tippett considers his relationship with the people to whom his work is offered.
To whom do I speak when I speak to you now? I do not know, though presumably to a portion of my public. Does it help that I can communicate with you in this way? It's an act of faith, surely, to address an invisible audience. Is that faith anything to do with a much deeper faith, the faith in the ultimate virtue of the creative act, which a composer must have to write music at all in this time? What, in this matter of the composer and his public, has been there always, and what is new? We have been for centuries used to receiving letters through the post, sheets of lines and blobs on paper, that when taken out of the envelope, tell us things, and often in such a tone that we can imagine the loved or hated voice speaking out of the ink. This is the primeval miracle of any communication at a distance. So living a thing indeed is a letter, that when Nora's husband in a doll's house tears up the letter that should have reached his wife, we feel that something has been done much more destructive than any burning of waste paper. Because the letter is a symbol of communication, and to prevent its reaching its destination is to do the two people concerned an injury. Or to be more up to date, we can think of Menotti's operetta, The Telephone, where a young man in a hurry has difficulty in proposing to his girl because she is so constantly interrupted by telephone conversations. The young man only succeeds when he has the sense to go out to the nearest call office and put his proposal by phone. The satire turns all upon the possibility that in modern society we value communication at a distance too much. But to be more up to date still, and to consider the techniques of communication by radio, is to be forced to admit the extraordinary immediacy of the method, particularly of television, so that insofar as communication is part of art, then surely the new conditions of communicating will affect to some extent all the various arts, particularly perhaps the art of music, because music only depends on the immediate perception of sound, and not, as in literature, on sight, or the reading of words, as though he had been sent a very long letter. I used to think, I remember, before radio came, that the song recital was tending to die out as a means of making music before a public, that it had had its day, and that with the decline of the recital would come the death of the song as a musical form. But radio suits the genius of the song recital very well, and the sound in our home can be intimate and delightful. Remembering what I once thought, I am gratified now to realize that I have since written works for voice and piano, and hope to write more. We respond to the new means to hand. Then again, a young composer must have always wondered just where his public was to be found. But in our day, when there seems a kind of law that the more seriously a composer applies himself to his art, the less public he can have at all, then the serious young composer may come to feel he can't start anywhere, that his public must remain ever non-existent. Yet the truth of the matter may be that his public is just of ones and twos, those few folk really interested in new things, and here it is that through the radio, if his music can once be played, his public of ones and twos can be assembled, so to speak, without assembling. This is, in fact, what does happen. Most new music begins its real public life on the radio. Nevertheless, radio hasn't changed our musical social life so radically that we go no more to concerts, because radio cannot reproduce all the real thing. And despite our new methods of communication by radio and television, the big public that wants to hear music in concert halls and see opera in theatres is still our idea of the musical public. If then I, as a composer, want to have a living relation with this big public that goes to concerts and operas, I must consider how to get round, or mitigate the incidence of that law which seems to say that the more serious a modern composer is, the less able he is to speak to anything beyond a coterie. Obviously, I can't alone, by myself, remove the wide and enduring disrelation between all new art and the big public. That there is such a disrelation now cannot be denied. Let's now call the composer and the public the producer and the consumer, because the relation between producer and consumer is certainly part of the relation between artist and public. But this relation is not so immediate and therefore so obvious in the arts as in commerce. If it were so, there would be the same demand for the latest music as there is for the latest house furnishing or for television. But as we all know, the popular demand for television is part of the general preoccupation of our society with gadgets and with speed and with mechanical progress, with a gay time, and not really a popular demand for art communicated through television. This huge public for radio or for films or for sport or whatever holds the demand of the consumer to be paramount. And insofar as this public is our government and state, then the modern bureaucratic machines also hold to this 100% consumer point of view. And seen from this point of view, the composer is only a servant of the big public, whose taste he must accept or starve. Put bluntly in this way, it does sound rather excessive, because we all know that the big public is extremely conservative and willing to ring the changes on a few beloved works till the end of time. So that our concert life, through the taste of this public, suffers from a kind of inertia of sensibility that seems to want no musical experience whatever that it does not already know. When this taste is indeed the national taste, the art of the nation certainly dies. But the creative artist is passionately determined that it shall not die. In fact, totalitarian societies, which are pathetically conformist and afraid of the new, have had to stamp him out. They are afraid, even of the struggling composer with his tiny public. And what are they afraid of? I think they are afraid of his passion, of his violence, of his unaccountability. For it's a fact of musical history, and this goes for the other arts as well, that during the last half century or even earlier, every major composer has at the outset found the taste of the big public and his consumer point of view unacceptable. And in counterblast, there has never been a period where so many manifestos have been issued demanding the absolute freedom of the artist to create what he likes, so many proclamations of a 100% producer point of view. I think of Bartok, who was certainly a victim of this division. To the end of his life, he had only relations with those small, select groups which side with the artists against the big public. He died in poverty. He stands a terrifying example of the maximum disrelation between a great creative energy and the mass public. And this brings me to my next point, which arises out of the fact that while patronage might have kept Bartók from undernourishment, he received in fact a great deal of patronage during his life, no amount of patronage could bring his extreme producer point of view into relation with the extreme consumer point of view of the big public. The big public instinctively hated his creative integrity, and no doubt Bartók, for all his courage, was hurt and haunted by this hate. Why does the big public hate extreme artistic integrity? How can a great composer like Bartók go forward at all in what looks like a voluntary cul-de-sac? Surely the matter is that the very big public masses together in a kind of dead passion of mediocrity, and that this blanket of mediocrity, whether communist or capitalist, is deeply offended by any living passion of the unusual, the rare, the rich, the exuberant, the heroic, and the aristocratic in art, the art of a poet like Yeats. While it's clear from Yeats's life and writings that in this very passion of defiance, an artist can find both material for his art and vigour for his despised activity, but he may starve. Because given our present disrelation between artist and public, It's obvious that patronage from one side, so to speak, from the public, and directed to satisfy the official taste, cannot, for that reason, be used honestly to satisfy the creative urges of the great artist. What alone has immortality, if there is to be such in any period, is the work of art, born from just this living passion of creation. The dead passion of mediocrity may kill the living artist and the nation's art, but it cannot project its own deadness beyond its own death. Having then outlined the general conditions as I see them, where do I stand myself? I must now affirm quite simply that I know of no other absolute in this matter than the power of such creative energies as I possess. That I look, therefore, at public and patronage through the eyes of a dedicated person who must do what he has to do, whether the issue is acceptable or not. That my passion is to project into our mean world music that is rich and generous. That I hope I hate mediocrity more intensely even than it hates me. That these violent words spring from the vigor and passion of my artistic life, and not from any violence in my person. Indeed, when the creative energies are not fully used up in bringing to expression what I need most deeply to say, then I have enjoyed doing works for specific commissions, works like the orchestral suite for Prince Charles's birthday. This is relatively simple and unambiguous. I've been less sure when a patron has wanted a work of art. I doubt if this can be done at all, except in the sense that the composer is given some financial assistance to his life while he writes such a work of art as he may, which amounts to the consumer agreeing to consume, or to try to consume, exactly what the producer produces. If the patron, whether an individual or a festival or the radio, if the patron has not understood clearly the reality of this situation, then the matter can easily be a cause for distress rather than relief. Patronage by the community at large of creative artists can only be easy and unambiguous in a society where all the artifacts, the gadgets if you like, the furnishings, the clothes, the songs, the poetry, the images, are all lovely and full of power and grace and of a fine and generous tradition. Such a society cannot be found in metropolitan Europe today, nor in Moscow, nor in New York. The beautiful things are rare. And state patronage is too much the mirror of the commonplace culture of our day to be able to alter this situation except occasionally and by accident, as when Le Corbusier builds a whole new city in India. A contemporary composer realizes all this fairly clearly. Sometimes he offers his talents for commercial gain, and sometimes he patronizes himself by obtaining money elsewhere. Sometimes he receives public financial help for the work of art he wants to compose. He must accept the last in fear and trembling. There is absolutely no guarantee that in this present period of cultural anarchy, his patron's taste will agree with his. He must hope it will be reasonably so. But of course the much deeper hope is a product only of his vigour as an artist. The hope that his work of art will belong in the great tradition.
That talk by Michael Tippett on A Composer and His Public was presented by the BBC.